Herzlich willkommen bei Meditation Coaching Alive. Mein Name ist Michael Kurt, auch bekannt als Curse. Und in dieser Folge hört ihr mein zweites Gespräch mit Lama Rod Owens. Sein neues Buch Lieben und Wut ist gerade auf Deutsch erschienen und sehr zu empfehlen. Viel Freude damit. Lama Rod Owens ist schon mal zu Gast gewesen bei mir hier im Podcast und es lohnt sich für euch auf jeden Fall auch diese erste Episode anzuhören. In der ersten Episode haben wir sehr viel darüber gesprochen, wie wir mit Wut umgehen können und mit Wut als Katalysator für sowohl spirituelle Entwicklung als auch soziale Veränderung. Lama Rod Owens Buch, sein zweites Buch, heißt Lieben und Wut in der deutschen Übersetzung und es ist jetzt gerade erschienen oder wenn ihr diesen Podcast hört, kommt es relativ bald raus. Lama Rod wird auch im März ein Retreat exklusiv für deutsche oder deutschsprachige Menschen leiten und die Infos dazu findet ihr in den Shownotes. Lama Rod ist als schwarzer Amerikaner aufgewachsen, der als Kind schon mit Ungleichheiten konfrontiert war. Ungleichheiten zwischen Arm und Reich, zwischen Schwarz und Weiß, zwischen Stadt und Land und der sehr früh in die aktivistische Tätigkeit gegangen ist. Er hat sehr früh für sich erkannt, dass er Veränderungen hervorrufen und auslösen möchte. Während dieser Arbeit hat er aber auch gemerkt, wie schnell er und seine Kolleginnen und Kollegen in dieser Arbeit ausbrennen können. Und hat über mehrere Umstände zum spirituellen Weg gefunden und hat angefangen, sich klassisch zum buddhistischen Lama ausbilden zu lassen. Diese ganze Geschichte hört ihr in dem ersten Teil vom Podcast. In diesem zweiten Teil hier, in diesem neuen Gespräch, sprechen wir spezifisch über Aspekte von Lama Rods Buch und seiner eigenen Praxis. Wie können wir Spiritualität von irgendwas Luftigem, ja, heiti-teiti, huiuiui, good vibes only mäßigen, wie können wir das auf den Boden der Tatsachen holen? Wie können wir uns mit uns selbst, unserer eigenen Lebensrealität, sowohl in unserem Körper als auch in unserer Welt, verbinden? Wie können wir das tun, wenn wir in unserer Vergangenheit schwere Traumata erfahren haben oder wenn wir sogar die Traumata unserer Vorfahren mit uns rumschleppen und vielleicht erstmal gar nicht wollen, dass wir mehr im Körper, mehr im Hier und Jetzt sind, mehr fühlen und mehr wahrnehmen? Was können wir dann tun? Wie begegnen wir auf eine Praxisart und Weise, auf eine meditative oder vielleicht wirklich innere Arbeitsart und Weise solchen Dingen wie sozialer Ungerechtigkeit und Rassismus und viele andere Dinge. Wir haben viel gelacht, beinahe geweint und uns sehr gut unterhalten. Ich freue mich sehr, mit euch jetzt zu teilen meine neue Unterhaltung mit Lama Rod Owens.
Welcome back to Meditation Coaching in Life. Dear Lama Rod, how have you been in the past crazy year and a half?
Yeah, it's been a lot. That's for sure. It's been a lot happening, a lot going on. Personally, I have actually been doing pretty well. You know, not that I haven't been struggling and having difficult periods, but for the most part, I feel as if my practice has been really strong to support me right now. So I'm grateful for that.
I think it's okay to say that one is doing comparatively well. It's weird to say it in these times, because you're reflecting about the world and people and politics and the earth. And then it's sort of like, yeah, but checking in with myself, it's going okay. It feels weird, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it can make you feel a little guilty. Because, you know, so many people aren't doing well and the earth isn't doing well and so forth, right? But I think it's really important for us to acknowledge that this is what practice does. You know, as a long-term practitioner, I've been practicing for, you know, close to 20 years now, probably a little more than that. You know, that at this point in my life, my practice can handle everything that comes up, like hopelessness and despair and sorrow and overwhelm and grief, you know, as well as holding space for the joy and the happiness and the gratitude and the connectedness that I feel as well. You know, like the discomfort and the suffering doesn't overwhelm me like it used to, you know, compared to my earlier days of practice where I just felt completely overwhelmed by everything in the world. But now I can experience the world and say, yeah, this is like difficult. This is hard, you know, and I have this incredible spaciousness in my mind that I've cultivated over all these years that can really hold everything as it arises. And because I can hold so much, I can be really active in supporting others as they're going through difficult experiences.
This is a very hopeful thing for you to say.
Yeah.
Because people are sometimes afraid that if they, we talked about this last time also, they're afraid if I go into a practice, a spiritual practice, a meditation practice, something like that, I'm neglecting the outside world because I can't hold both of it. So now you're saying, no. Even though it might feel like that in the beginning, after time, you're creating more space for the world as well. And we're right in the territory of the book.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
Mm-hmm. I feel this is a big part of what the book is speaking to me personally about. A lot of times we say, you know, there are certain teachings for certain times, you know, and I think this book is a teaching for this time. And so I'm very happy that it's coming out in German now.
Yeah.
And so because a lot of people have asked me after our last conversation, it's like, oh, is it out in German? And people are using Google Translate to sort of put the PDF, you know, put the PDF in there, you know, whatever helps, you know. So it's coming in German now. And it's a teaching for the time. And there's one sentence that there's many sentences that stuck with me, but one I would like to reflect to you in the beginning. And maybe you can say something about that because it feels to me like that's the territory right there. The sentence is, if we don't do the work, we become work for other people.
I just, you know, that's just like such a reality, you know, because when I began my practice, you know, my meditation practice years ago, I became really aware of the ways in which I was creating suffering for other people because I just didn't have the awareness to name like how I was reacting to my anger and taking it out on other people around me, right? Or how like I was forcing people to do emotional labor for me, you know, because I couldn't possibly understand and hold what I was experiencing in the moment.
Right? Could you say something? Could you elaborate what you mean when you say you're sort of forcing other people to do emotional labor for you?
Yeah. I think when people love us and care for us, they want us to be well. And so I think that when we're just really in difficult places, the people who love us feel as if they're compelled to step up, to really help us, to take care of us, you know? And I was forcing a lot of people to do that because I didn't know how to take care of myself. You know, but that's just one way of looking at it, right? The other way that I see often is that, you know, we live in a collective, like we're in just in this huge community, and there are people who just aren't taking care of themselves, right? And so when we're around those people, we have to do work to take care of them, and we have to do work to take care of ourselves at the same time, right? So that's another example. You know, and I think a lot of us are just really taking on a lot of collective emotional labor right now because there are so many people who are just so overwhelmed, right? Who are so angry, so depressed, so, you know, so sad about what's happening for them in their lives and for our communities and countries and so forth, you know, that they just don't know, you know, how to take care of themselves. So we're trying to do. Those of us who have the capacity of trying to do a lot of work, and that exhausts us as well.
Yeah.
You know, so this is why I say that, like, if I'm not doing work for myself, then I'm actually creating labor, work for others around me. And I don't want to do that. Personally, I want to take care of myself as much as possible, you know, so I can be of help. That doesn't mean that, like, there are times when I absolutely need to receive care from others. But I want that I want people to consent to that, not be forced to do that work for me. I want to ask for people to hold me instead of forcing them to hold me.
Ah, that's beautiful. But in order to be able to even ask, you have to develop a sensitivity for, and you have to be able to identify and sort of communicate this need. So that is something that you are developing through the practice.
Yes. You know, it's developing the awareness to name what I need. You know, I want people to develop a habit of always asking ourselves what we need. I ask myself what I need all the time. You know, as soon as I get up, as soon as I wake up in the morning, I ask myself, okay, what do I need? What do I need to do today? What do I need to do in this moment? Like all throughout this day, you know, leading up to our interview, I've just been kind of asking myself, okay, what do I need? What do I need to do? And I let that need direct the work that I do today.
How do you differentiate between a need and an impulse?
Well, an impulse, and I would also call that a want, like needs and wants. You know, an impulse or a want can be a need as well. But this is like my basic, you know, reflection. And this reflection is I ask myself, okay, how does feeling this need help me to do important work today? You know, for an example, right? So I was asking myself as I was preparing for our interview, what I needed to do in order to feel resourced enough to share this time with you, you know? So one of the things became, oh, I need to have food before, you know, we have this talk. I need to have water before this talk. I need to use the restroom before this talk. Right. I should do some other work that, you know, needs to be done before like this talk so I can really concentrate on our time together. You know, so it's identifying what has to be done, you know. But I go a little further, you know, in my practice and say, you know what, how can I take care of people? So my ultimate need and goal, I suppose, is to take care of people, to support people, right? And then I ask myself, okay, what do I need to do for myself in order to be resourced enough to care for others? You know, and those basic needs are rest, you know, and food and space and, you know, and so forth and so on. It's different for all of us, but those are some of my basic needs that I you know, need to fill for myself. And if I can't fill that for myself, then I skillfully ask others for support.
It's beautiful that you said that, because especially when we want to take care of other people, I have it. I'm sure a lot of people can identify. There can be a tendency to just run over yourself because you're saying, well, I'm not as important in this moment as the work I'm doing, the help I'm giving the other person and so on. It has a sense of maybe nobility, you know, like noble suffering, something like that. Like I'm giving myself up for other people. But of course, it's wonderful if you put it in that order. If you say, yes, I would like to take care of someone else. What do I need for myself in order to be able to best do that? Right. And this word resource is wonderful. There's also another quote that I love. It says, I'm paraphrasing, you say that your interest is not specifically that someone has like any specific spiritual practice, you know, but that the people have enough resources to not be violent against themselves or other people. And could you say a little bit to that?
Yeah, you know, I believe for myself that the most important thing for me to work towards is the reduction of violence for myself and for others, right? And I label that spiritual. I think the reduction of violence is an expression of spirituality, right? You know, because when there's no violence, there becomes space for healing and connectivity and love and compassion, right? You know, and so when I look at other people, like I don't care, you know, if people are Buddhist or Christian or have any other spiritual practice. I'm not really interested in that. I'm interested in people understanding what is harmful and violent for themselves and others around them, and then figuring out a way to reduce that violence. That may mean spiritual practice or religion. That may mean maybe another set of philosophies, right, that are more appropriate for you, right? But I want to be an agent to help people figure out what they need in order to reduce violence.
What would be an entry to that? Like, what would be if someone would say, okay, well, I really don't know what that means for me personally. How can I find out? How can I start exploring that or feeling that? What would be like sort of a first key in the door in order to explore that, in order to feel that?
Yeah, I mean, the best way to do that is to ask other people what their experience of us is.
Mm.
You know, you can start with like the people that are closest to you, right? And just asking, okay, when are times I've hurt you?
Mm.
Right? You know, and start there, because it's hard for us to just start developing an awareness of how we impact others around us. Like that's a hard place to start. It's easier to start with asking others how they experience us. And then that becomes a doorway for us to start thinking about, okay, like, oh, that this thing that I do and say is actually quite harmful and hurtful for people, right? And I can start there and like figuring out a way to do something different that reduces the harm of that activity.
How do we then, could we ask ourselves the same question? Could we sort of ask ourselves, hey, me, Mike, Rod, whatever, what am I doing? You know, how am I hurting you? How am I hurting myself? Could that go inwards as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. You know, I think that's a harder place to start, but it's not impossible. Right. Mm-hmm. I think there has to be a willingness for truth to arise, you know. But again, it's really also really important to compare what we discover about ourselves with other people's experience of us, you know, because there are certain things maybe that like we may think they're really harmful and violent, and then we ask someone what their experience of this thing is, and they may say, oh, I don't, you know, it doesn't seem harmful or violent to me, but maybe it's something that I'm struggling with for myself, you know?
Yes.
So there are things that like we just struggle with that no one else notices as well, right?
Catching me like push, 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 like shooting arrows in my heart. Yeah. It's true. A lot of times that might be an experience, you know, we can be afraid of, you know, asking people or sharing something with you because we put ourselves, we might have a tendency to criticize ourselves very harshly, to have a lot of guilt and shame around certain things. So we never express them, you know, because we think if I already sort of really put myself in a prison for this, what would other people do?
Yes.
And sometimes the experience can be you put it out and the other person's like, oh, wow, you think that, oh, I'm so sorry for you because it's never been an issue.
Yeah, or like you put it out there and someone else says, oh my God, I struggle with the same thing. And then all of a sudden you start moving through shame because shame is about isolation. But when you start connecting to people who are sharing similar experiences, you start belonging and connecting, you know, but so many of us, you know, really struggle with naming, these experiences mm-hmm. for ourselves. Like, and these experiences, again, as you pointed out, like these are just our stories that no one else is actually paying attention to. You know, it's like, you know, for me, like embarrassment, you know, is something that like isn't a huge deal for me, you know, mm-hmm. because I begin to see, you know, in experiences that I felt embarrassment was that like a lot of people weren't even paying attention to mm-hmm. what was happening, right? You know, and even beyond that, when something embarrassing happened, I just started thinking, my God, like everyone else has experienced this before. Like, why do I think I'm like so special and isolated and targeted? Like everyone has messed up in the way that I've messed up in this moment. And then that helps me to move through the shame into the connecting to everyone, you know.
That's a huge key from moving out of this shame and this isolation. Isolation is a wonderful word. If you feel like, I'm not belonging, I can't, you know, share myself, I can't, whatever, you know, you isolate from the outside, but you also isolate yourself from certain parts inside of you that you might feel shame, guilt, or whatever about. And one thing that I think is very wonderful in your book is your emphasis again and again on bringing sort of meditation and spiritual practices out of a lofty sort of let's get away from the world situation and moving it into a very real lived experience that connects to our lived experience. And it has many layers. And so one thing I would like to ask you about first is the connection with the body. You know, because we think sometimes maybe a meditation or even this kind of inquiry, it's something that's going on in our head, in our mind, and, you know, so I have a thought and this is what I think about it and so on. And there are many things you say about the body, and I would like to just, well, where do I start? I just pick one out. You're saying something along the lines of when you are not connected to your body, you're also not connected to the earth. To the ground, you know, right. And this is also something where if you want to be in the world, the vehicle to actually that you are in the world is through your embodiment, through your right. body. Right. So how would you approach being embodied and coming into the body and beginning to build this connection? Because, mm-hmm. and here, you know, it's a huge topic because how do I feel embodied? Do I want to feel embodied? Maybe there's trauma there. Maybe there's pain. Do I want to touch it? Right. So, yeah, how do we begin there?
Yeah. Well, I also think it's really important to point out that there may be some of us who will never experience embodiment in this life because of the level of trauma that we experience, right? I think embodiment is a kind of continuum. Right. It's like we're all at different places along this path of embodiment. I think the first step for all of us, you know, regardless of where we're at on this path, is to acknowledge that we do have a body. Like it sounds really simple, but it's actually where we have to begin. Like I have to acknowledge that there is a physical expression of who I am in this moment. Right. And that's going to start getting us closer to the body, right? Just saying, okay, there's a body here. There's a physicality here, right? And then depending on where we're at, right, we can go a little further, right, and to begin to maybe notice sensations within our bodies, right? But that becomes tricky depending on the level of trauma yeah. that we're working with, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe I can't get to sensations because that's a really intense experience for me. But maybe I just kind of stay with acknowledging that there's a physical body, you know, and maybe I stay there for a while, you know. And then, of course, we can like call in other modalities like somatic work and movement and so forth that actually helps us to develop doorways and entry points you know, into our body. So maybe you can't be with a sensation, but maybe you can be with an experience that feels very neutral, you know, like an experience of the physical body that just isn't good or bad. It just is. And that's another important doorway for people to get into, right? Mm-hmm. You know, but for me, in my practice, it's like I have struggled with my body because I feel as if, and have felt more strongly in the past, that like my body isn't good enough, you know, which can be an expression of trauma as well. So I've never wanted, in the past, I didn't want to be in my body because I was like, I want something better. You know, like I need to be thinner, I need to be more attractive, or whatever it may be for me to actually come back to my body. So it wasn't even about sensation necessarily, it's about wanting something better. Right. Yeah. And this is where self-love and love of body come into play, because I had to go through a lot of work of learning how to accept my body as it was. You know, not to say that like I'm not engaged in like these improvements of my body.
Yeah.
You know, like I have like braces now for my teeth and like I'm actively losing weight and I have like skincare products and I like I'm getting into fashion. Like all that stuff is
good on you.
Yeah. It's like ways that like I'm using skillfully to develop a deeper love in my body that my body deserves to be cared for. Not to necessarily improve my appearance, but to develop an ethic of care for my body.
Would you say that that there is an issue there or a feeling there of it's a difference if you do these things because you're problematizing, you know, like, oh, I have to do this, I have to do that in order to, and then I can feel connected.
Right.
That's one way to approach. Right. And the other way would be like, no, I do feel connected to my body and I do feel, you know, compassion maybe even. And out of compassionate care, this is what I would like to bring to it, you know?
Yeah.
You know, maybe more softness, you know? For me, it was a lot of softness. For me, I had a many, many years of just connecting with my body through like extreme situations or rigorous things or pain or sex or something, but it always had to be some kind of like something, you know, like it wasn't compassionate at all, you know, because there was some very, very high disconnect, you know, and to connect with another side and sort of say like, oh, well, maybe my body wants me to actually like, you know, hold myself or like move in the room is a very crazy experience because there's also so many, I think all of us have it in a very different way. There's so many tales attached to how one should relate to the body. You know, what is acceptable for a man or a German or, you know, whatever it is, you know, to sort of, it might take some time to break through these, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Like these are all cultural narratives that we take on, and they become these truths for us, you know, where we say, well, this is how I should be, like this is what's okay to do, this is what isn't okay to do, and so forth, right? You know, I did this really intense labor of, you know, just going directly to the trauma within my body. You know, and I knew that like I would never be able to really be at home in my body until I just really did this intense work with trauma, you know, moving through it, releasing it, and so forth, right? And when that happened, I discovered that there was all this room for me to be in the body. Like I felt like I was sharing space with trauma, and trauma was a really bad roommate. You know, and so when I was able to
leaving release, its stuff everywhere,
exactly, like just making it really uncomfortable to be at home, you know, I just didn't want to be here, you know. So you have to evict that roommate, the roommate of trauma. And then once I really started coming into my body, I really developed this really strong, intense love for my body where I really wanted to care for it. Like I was like, oh, like this is, like I have the energy now to really care for my body because I need to care for my body because this is an important vehicle for me to be in the world right now. And again, it goes back to this like ethic of care. It's like, if I really want to take care of people, I have to figure out how to take care of myself. You know, when my body shuts down, then I'm no longer able to be of help for others, right?
Would you say that another layer could be that we sometimes have to sort of discover certain things in ourselves, certain issues, certain limitations and so on, in order to be of service also to other people when we see them going through this? It doesn't mean, oh, I know how to do it.
Right.
But it's sort of, it could mean, ooh, I know the place that you are in right now, and I can be there with you because, you know, I don't feel the need to do something or fix it or something, you know, because I know that space.
Yeah, I think that barrier, or the primary barrier for many of us, is fear. It's like when we encounter the suffering of others, like we get really scared, you know. We're not necessarily scared of their suffering. We're actually scared of our suffering. Like other people's suffering reminds us of our own suffering, or the work that we're not doing to take care of our suffering. Right. So I can't be emotionally available for the suffering of those around me because I'm not available for mine. Right. If I'm not available for my suffering, then my support of others becomes really an act of pity. You know, and pity really is about power. You know, it's saying that like, oh, like you're really messed up, poor you, you know. And I'm not even like thinking about how I'm actually in the same situation. Like I am actually struggling with the same situation, right? But I refuse to acknowledge that because the only way for me to feel good in my relationship to your suffering is to kind of push you down and to, you know, to kind of pity you and say, poor you. And that helps me to feel better because somehow I've convinced myself that I'm somehow better, you know. And that's, pity is like probably one of the most dangerous kinds of care that people offer, you know, because you're just kind of like blaming people in a way. But another way that pity is violence is that it becomes what we would call pathologizing. So pathologizing means that, you know, you're suffering and you're just like, that's what you do. You suffer. You're inherent. Like, that's who you are. You're just like pain, right?
Yes.
Pain is an experience. It's not who we are. Like, but if we don't understand that for ourselves, we'll never understand that for anyone else in the world.
Yes.
You know?
There is, I love that when you say pain is an experience.
Mm-hmm.
It is not who we are. Your book is called Love and Rage in German. Lieben. In German, they translated it as loving and anger.
Oh.
So not love, but loving, like the act of love, which I thought was quite interesting. Quite interesting. So, but we're also talking. You're speaking about anger, you know, obviously. And there is just a quick thing is like in your book, you have, you describe sort of, you give the setting for these teachings and for how they are applicable and so on. But then you also go into a certain exercises, just practical things that people can do for themselves, with themselves, in order to move out of theory and put this into practice, right? And experiment. And one thing that I love is that you don't give the easy way out in the way where you're like, okay, you're angry,
yeah,
right? Because in the moment that you say, I am angry, right? There is multiple layers. First of all, what's that? Am, what's that? Yeah. And then anger. But we look at, you look at the anger and you open it up and you break it down. You say, well, anger is a psychological experience and it's also a physical experience. And then let's look at the psychological side. Let's look at the physical side. And then you even go one step further and you say, well, and in these aspects, it also has different layers, you know, and different aspects. So we can even look at the different layers of this emotion of anger. So it seems to me like it's an unraveling of something that we feel is so concrete. I am angry. Like, this is me, right? And this is the anger, and it's stuck, and it's there, it's solid, and here it is. And then an unraveling starts taking place. Well, what does that really mean? So I would love if you could to sort of to hear from you how this process is of sort of untangling this very concrete feeling. For example, well, you know, with the example of anger or pain or whatever, you know.
Right. And I think, you know, the only way for us to do this untangling is to get close to the emotion or to the experience itself, right? And so when you get close to something, you know, it's like, it reminds me of the paintings, these huge paintings that are, they look like an image, like one solid image, but when you get close, they're actually a composite of like thousands of pictures.
Yes.
And I love those. I love that kind of art, you know? And this is what it means to get close to an experience or an emotion. Like the closer you get, you're like, oh my God, there are a lot of different pieces that are coming together to create this one experience, right? And as you pointed out, right, it's like the sense of self and I, right? And there's this energy, and there's the body, then there's my mind that's labeling all of this, right? And if you can just like offer this whole process space, it begins to break up, right? And the point that we're trying to get to is moving from reactivity to responding, you know? And I'll never be able to respond to something as long as I'm habitually reacting to this process. That's actually just minor processes put together, right? You know, that I'm just habitually reacting to, but I can disrupt that reactivity by just saying, you know what? No, I'm just going to watch this. I'm going to feel it. I'm going to experience this. Just let the energy move through our experience without feelings if we have to get involved. You know, and then you begin to see all these different things that are being put together to create, for instance, an experience of emotion, of an experience of anger. You know, I'm not just angry, you know, I am hurt, you know, but I'm not just hurt, I'm experiencing hurt. There's an experience of hurt, right? And then I don't want to hurt. Right. But I don't know how to stop hurting. So I get really frustrated. Right. Well, there's a tension that arises between being hurt and not wanting to hurt. Right. And in that tension, I start reacting to it. And then that's where the anger arises. The anger is a reactivity, you know, and it's the reactivity to basically just wanting to not be hurt, you know. But it's, the wisdom of this also says that the only way for me to experience freedom from hurt is to actually allow the hurt to be there, not to run away from it, not to cover it up, but to experience it, to get curious about what hurt feels like in my mind, what it feels like in my body, right?
It is so counterintuitive.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is why anger feels so natural for us, because we think, oh, like anger is actually helping me to feel better because I feel this energy and I feel like I can do something maybe to change the situations that, you know, that triggered me. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Yeah. Anger has a lot of like the juicy side of anger is this, the activeness, the power that you feel to act.
You know, and we get kind of addicted. That power, like when I'm experiencing anger, I feel powerful, you know.
Yeah,
but the real power that I discovered is actually through learning how to experience what's arising for me. That's the real power, because I feel like I have agency over my mind and body in that moment. Like I don't have to rely on something else outside of me to take care of me. I can take care of myself by just showing up and just noticing what this experience feels like, right? And the more you show up to it, the more you experience, you know, what's arising, the more it changes. You know, it turns into a different story, you know.
So it's really, it would even be something where you could even say, you give examples in your book, man, you know, mm-hmm. plentiful, to sort of like massage the ideas also into some people who might be like, whoa, you know, why would I want to sit with my anger? It's like, okay, well, I have this example, I have this story, and you know, maybe I can bring it there. And I like it that you unravel it, but there's also, even though dealing with very intense topics, you know, you describe very painful experiences of racism, of very many different things. But it seems to me there is some kind of softness and tenderness with which you would like us to approach these experiences. You know, just even before, when you said, well, some people, you know, you go right into the trauma, but some people might just find something neutral or just find some space to begin. So I think my question is this. Maybe I'd like to hear one more time how one would softly and with tenderness get a little bit closer to being able to just experience these intense emotions.
Yeah. Well, I think a really skillful way is to think about others, right? It's to say, well, I'm not the only one trying to do this, right? I'm not a failure. I'm not doing this wrong. I'm doing this in a way that is natural and that makes sense. You know, that when I begin to approach my experience with gentleness, it's a way that, like, I can take care of myself in the moment as well. You know, and again, I think that, like, we're so deeply informed by these notions, you know, of, you know, work and accomplishment.
Yes.
You know, that the body and our mental health isn't something we're trying to accomplish or achieve. It's something we're trying to care for. Caring isn't about achieving and working. It's about holding and nurturing. You know, it's about acknowledging a different kind of timeline that isn't productive. Like, we have to get rid of this notion of productivity.
Yes.
You know, caring isn't about being productive. It's about, you know, it's about nurturing. It's about tending to, right? It's about holding. It's healing. Mm. Like, it's healing.
Do you have the experience of people saying, okay, so how long do I have to do this meditation to see the results?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Right. Right. Of course, I started there myself. When I started meditating, I was like, I really need to suffer less by the end of the week. Yeah. You know?
Good. Fair enough. You know?
Yeah. You know, I thought it was very fair goals. But it has to be goalless. We do start meditating and doing kind of healing modalities because we want a different experience. Absolutely. Yes. But we have to let go of how that experience will arise and when it will arise. You know, when I start a practice, you know, I started with an intention of saying, you know what, I want to see something happen. Like, this is why I'm doing it, right? But then I let go of when and how that's going to happen, right? And I just do the practice, right? And then whatever arises in terms of accomplishment or change is wonderful. Even if it's just a little bit, it's still enough because I didn't have any agenda except for something to happen, right? But it's a dead end to start a meditation practice with expectations, you know, that something specific is going to happen. It's fine to start it and say, well, I want something to happen, you know, and that's it. Let it go. Something's going to happen. Right. And then focus your attention on the practice itself. Right. And that's how that's the gentleness of approaching our experience. It's like, yeah, I'm just letting go and seeing what happens.
Changing the timeline is wonderful. Mm-hmm. And also, it really stuck with me that you said, what we're doing here, this kind of thing, is not, we sometimes call it doing work or working on ourselves or whatever, but it's not work in the way of achieving, but it's caring for, as you would care for a loved one, where it's, you know, where the care itself is the act that you're doing. It's not like I'm improving this person. No, I'm being with this person. I'm caring for this person. I'm holding this person.
Yeah. That's real authentic caretaking. Is when we enter into relationships with people, we have no agendas but to show up and just care.
Wonderful if we can apply that for ourselves also. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You speak about heartbreak in your book. And there are different aspects of heartbreak. In our last discussion, we spoke about sort of holding a cognitive dissonance. When you have a chapter about me, it's called Me Too and the Guru, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know. So we had some discussion about this. But one thing we didn't discuss last time, but I wanted to pick it up this time because it's also a poignant part in the German translation. And it's about your experiences with racism.
Yeah.
You know. And it is your unique personal experience, but it's a universal experience for many, many people, for many people of color in Germany, for, you know, so this experience of, and I think it was very powerful and poignant to put it in the context of heartbreak, I think. And just quickly, the reason why it was also something that really stuck with me is because there's an editor's note in the book in German, which says we've kept the N-word. We've kept it in here, you know, mm-hmm. in order to, you know, because this is what we want to express, you know?
Yeah.
And I found it interesting to have this note also for the German readership, you know? And so it stuck with me. And then this in the context of heartbreak, because, you know, you speak about this experience of racism in American society. It's all through the book, of course, in different aspects, you know. Yeah. But maybe you could speak to the aspect of heartbreak that's in there for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, the heartbreak is first having to deal with or be in relationship to a reality that is being defined for you.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, and that's a reality that takes power away from you.
Yes.
Instead of empowering you. Like that's the fundamental heartbreak. Like that I'm always struggling with agency. With having the right to choose, right? Having the right to have access to the resources that I need to be well, right? You know, and using like, you know, racial slurs, right, to degrade is a way that we take power away from people, right? You know, of course, this is like very relevant for like German people and German history.
Oh yeah.
You know, with the Holocaust, like, yes. And that's, you know, we have to learn from the ways in which power is always being taken away from people in order to enact violence on them, you know? So that's something that I'm pissed off about, right? I'm like angry about that.
Yes.
But I know that the real truth is that I'm just really hurt by that. And that hurt, when I get close to that hurt, I feel a softening, you know, that softens the anger a little bit, that softens my desire to want to hurt people as much as they've hurt me. You know, and I begin to understand that, like, I'm not the only one with this brokenheartedness. Actually, the people who are trying to hurt me the most are themselves also really struggling to be well. They're struggling with their own pain and trauma and heartbrokenness. And they're reacting to their discomfort by targeting me, thinking that that's somehow going to erase, you know, their discomfort. And when in fact, it's going to deepen it. You know, and so holding that wisdom, you know, in our practice, but that wisdom, you can't get to that wisdom until you get to the heartbreak, you know. Mm. And it's always important, like in the book, I'm really careful in saying that, like, I'm not interested in the anger disappearing or going anywhere. That's not the point. The yes. anger isn't the issue. For me, it's my reactivity. The anger is still really important for me, you know, because anger still tells me that there's something wrong.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And what's wrong is that there's imbalance, there's injustice, there's hurt, there's discrimination, there's something happening that's harming me, that's creating, you know, hurt for myself, for others around me. Right. You
know. So the anger is still very valid in yeah. as a, it's pointing to something. It's like, okay, it's like a prick, right? Like a needle, you know, it's like, or like whatever, you know, however you want to, you know, excuse my English, but sort of like a, it's like a signal. Okay. Right. Here is something. And then the question becomes, okay, what next? What now? You know? And I love the word that you used, agency. You know, sort of having the then not coming from a, okay, here's anger. This is what I usually do. But it's like, okay, here's the anger. Here's the alarm bell. Okay, great. Now I use the resources and the agency that I have in order to make a maybe even more impactful decision about this, you know?
That's it. That's the wisdom of response. Responsiveness, that's what we're trying to get to. I want to choose how to respond, not just habitually react. But react without thinking, react without knowing the impact of my actions, right? So reactivity sounds really quick. Responsiveness, on the other hand, sounds really slow and methodical. But over time, responsiveness can be as quick as reactivity. Of course, that comes with practice, right? I think that concerns people when they're like, oh, you know, I have to choose a response, particularly in a moment where something needs to happen really quickly. And I say, yes, you can actually learn to respond very quickly. I think there are professions like medical, you know, emergency professionals and fields that like have trained to respond as wisely and as quickly as possible to crisis, right? And we can do the same for ourselves in our personal life.
I think of an example I sometimes think about because it's so unexpected, because it has to do with the violence, mm-hmm. is a person who is trained in martial arts and a person mm-hmm. who's not trained
yeah.
when they're attacked, mm-hmm. right? Your martial arts training, you know, it doesn't make you slower or less mm-hmm. effective, quite the opposite. You know, so why would you not be able to apply the same thing to emotional, psychological ways of dealing with situations, you know? I would like to close this on a happy note. Once again, I have to repeat, it is a teaching for this time, and it is a teaching for, I hope you're okay with me calling it a teaching, because to me it is.
So, yeah, absolutely.
It is a teaching for this time, and it is something that can be of wonderful benefit to many people that I personally know, including myself. So I'm very grateful that you are putting yourself in your history, in your pain and your experiences, and also opening up, being vulnerable in order to put this out and share it. So I'm very grateful for this. And I like to end it on a wonderful sentence. And maybe if you can say something to that, it's okay. Happiness is the space in which we dance with even the toughest shit in our minds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, happiness is space for me, basically. Happiness is this kind of openness, this kind of experience where I feel as if I can allow everything to come and go, you know, and within the spaces around things coming and going, there's a kind of contentment and a gratitude for me. You know, that like I can deal with the challenges of the world, but there's still a lot of space. So those challenges don't become overwhelming for me. They're still challenging, but they're not overwhelming. When I say something's challenging, that means I just have to put a lot of effort, you know, into moving through that challenge, you know, and responding wisely and creating ways and methods of, you know, working with it. But it doesn't mean that it's overwhelming. When something becomes overwhelming, I become really shut down. Mm-hmm. It's like being buried in a way. And I'm not active anymore. I'm not doing anything. I'm just suffering. Mm-hmm. Right? You know, so when there's a space, there's all this potential to not be overwhelmed, you know, and to give everything the space that it needs to pass through our experience at its own time.
So happiness is not the absence of struggle or the absence of shit in the mind.
Absolutely.
But happiness is the great vast expanse in which it's which can hold all of that.
Yeah.
And it's possible to move and dance with it and have enough room to do so.
Yeah?
It's a wonderful inspiration to hear that from your experience, this is possible to, it's possible to experience this. And there are methods that you can use in order to familiarize with it and practice this and open yourself to this. Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing those.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Wenn dir die Themen aus diesem Podcast zusagen und du noch ein bisschen tiefer einsteigen willst, dann lade ich dich ein, auf www.curse.de zu schauen. Da findest du verschiedene Meditationskurse und weitere Infos zu all diesen Themen. Du kannst dich natürlich mit uns in Verbindung setzen. Schreib eine Mail an coaching@curse.de oder komm rüber zu Instagram und find mich unter @cursezeit oder bei Facebook unter curseofficial. Komm, wenn du möchtest, auch in unsere Facebook-Gruppe. Du findest sie unter Stell dir vor, du wachst auf. Und meine beiden Bücher Stell dir vor, du wachst auf und 199 Fragen an dich selbst sind ebenfalls überall erhältlich.